Good evening, everyone. This evening, the News and Views Committee proudly presents to you Dr. Sidney Girard. Dr. Girard is now a professor of psychology at the University of Florida at Gainesville. He has been past president of the Humanist Psychologists Association of America, and he has written many books, of which one of them is Transparent Self. So with this moderate introduction, I present to you Dr. Sidney Girard.
Hello. I want to talk to you about some ideas that have been fascinating and exercising me for the past few years, and to give a kind of lecture and demonstration of what the ideas are about. It's concerned with such vague terms as self-actualization, personal growth, discovering your possibilities and the possibilities of the world. I don't have a script, but we'll see where it leads. Let's begin with this assumption about man. I'm existentially oriented, and I believe with the existentialists that this enigmatic statement is true. Man's essence is his existence, or man's existence precedes his essence. Now, what in the blazes does that mean? It means essentially that the stuff of which we're made, bones and blood and guts and flesh and habit, is better regarded as a kind of raw material, sort of a plastic material, not in the sense of artificial, but plastic like plasticine. It can be molded and shaped within some limits that we've never discovered. And the same is true of the being of the world, that the stuff of which the world is made, minerals and soil and animals and trees and so on, these too are malleable and have more possibilities than appear to us when we first see the world. Look at yourself and think of yourself for a minute. What you see right now and what you feel is some splinter of the possible ways in which you can, first of all, be embodied. It's a splinter of the possibilities of the way in which you can experience the world. And it's a splinter of the possibilities in which the world can be for you. So let's take as a working hypothesis then that you and I are animated fractions of our own possibilities, and that everything conspires to prevent us from imagining and discovering and making real more possibilities of ourselves and the world than are now true for us. So let's begin with your surname, or I'll begin with my surname. It's Girard. And when you name me Girard, you're not just describing my family lineage, because I am the son of my father and my mother, and then the grandson of my grandparents and the nephew of my aunts and uncles. And the name Girard, if I act in a way that doesn't stay in keeping with the name Girard, I bring dishonor to my family, and they'll disown me. I've got to be in the world in the way of a Girard, whatever that is. And that already is a definition of some of my limits, isn't it? Because suppose being in the world in the way of a Smith, or a Breed, or a Spitalny was more fun If I started to be in the world like a Spitalny and my parents saw me, they might disown me. They might, in fact, regard me as crazy and hospitalize me, so that one's own surname is already a reduction of the possible ways in which one can experience oneself in the world and act in the world. Now go on further to your first name. My first name is Sydney, and for one reason or another, I have been in the world in a certain way. I have looked a certain way, I've behaved in a certain way, and I've experienced myself on the inside in a certain way. If I start experiencing new dimensions of myself, that might scare me silly. Let's say I'm chronically straight, and that's what I recognize as Sydney. I have no anger, I have no lust, I have no passion, I am intelligent, rational, cool, clean-cut, and a Boy Scout. And let's say that I look at a pretty girl, as from time to time I do, and I experience lust, and interest, and passion, and non-rationality. But let's say I conceal this from you. So from your point of view, I still look like Sydney. You still recognize me as the person I was yesterday. But I know that I am more than you see. What do I do with that awareness that there is more to me than you see? First of all, it might scare me silly. Good God, look at what I am feeling. I must be out of my mind. I might then repress it in order to appear to myself and to you as that Gerard named Sydney. And if I do that, I am evading growth. My names are an invitation or a command not to change. Okay, now let's see what else prevents a person from changing. Changing in what particulars? In his ways of perceiving and remembering and imagining and feeling, and then in his ways of acting in this world. What else prevents you from altering in some significant way the way that you experience and act in this world? First of all, there are the other people who are in your world who know you. They know me as Sydney Gerard, and perhaps they like me, they stay married to me, they hire me, they invite me to their home. As long as my action, and then beyond that, my experience remains in certain limits. If I should let the people who know me as that Gerard named Sydney, if I should let them know some of the things that I've done that I remember, but they've never seen, and if I were to let them know that I think and feel and imagine some of the things that I do, then I might have to pay heavily for their discovery. And so I try to conceal from them some of the dimensions of my own experience and action. In a sense, then, the other people in my life invite me to remain as the person they knew me to be. What else? The arrangement of the environment, the physical and social environment. Here you get into biology and techniques of survival and adaptation. But the very arrangement of furniture and rooms and architecture is a way to constrain you to be in your body and to move your body in the ways that are associated with your own first and last name. There are houses that the only way that you can move in them is like this, because there's no room. And there's expensive furniture around. And you are literally being invited or ordered to be in your body and to move your body in a way that's fit for neither man nor beast. All right, what else conspires to keep you the way you now are? Your very self-structure, your self-concept and your self-ideal and your public selves. I'm quoting my own writing in a textbook, my way of talking about the self-structure. That conspires to keep you the way you are. Your various social roles, your age, your sex, your family role, your occupational role are all factors that keep you the way you are. Okay, so that lots and lots of things conspire to keep you experiencing yourself in a way that you recognize and feel is your own identity, and that keep you visible to others in a way that they will recognize you as the person you are. Just a quick digression. I can never resist a digression. What's your first name? Pardon? Suzanne? Suzanne, let's try a little experiment just now. All right, I'm talking to you, Suzanne. Well, Bill, do you remember when you and I played handball last week? The weather was about 90 degrees and we were both sweating very heavily. And you said, Sid, you really played a good game. And I said, Bill, it wasn't that good. I really liked the way you played. Do you feel I'm talking to you? Not really, indeed. It's a case of mistaken identity, isn't it? That I'm taking you to be Bill, but you're really Susan. And you stop and think for a minute of all the instances where someone addresses you and you don't recognize yourself as the person being addressed. That most of our life is a case of living with others who mistake our identity. And so we don't recognize ourselves in full as the person being addressed. It's as if, let's say, one has concealed much of one's being from his mother and father, and so they call you by your first name and attribute all kinds of things to you, which you know damn well are not true. It's as if your name is Bill and they're calling you George. And yet many of us dare not reveal our true identity, because to reveal our true identity is to be like a spy in a foreign country blowing your cover. You're afraid that if you reveal your true identity, will the real Sidney Gerard stand forth? You're afraid you'll be executed or divorced or fired or deported or all of those things. Well, the very fact that we dread having our true identity known is yet another factor that prevents us from growth. This is incidentally what the talk tonight is about. Growth, change, the discovery and the making real of more of your possibilities than the banal splinter that you now happen to be, or that I now happen to be. Whoever you are is a splinter of your possibilities and a splinter of the possibilities of the world, because I agree with Ronald Lang that one of the ways to define a person is a way for the world to be experienced. A person is a way for the world to be imagined. Be careful how you imagine the world to be, because it might happen, especially if you share your imagination as to how the world might or ought to be, because it might turn on other people's fantasy in the same way, and they will help you make it the way you imagine it to be. I've been obsessed and fascinated with Adolf Hitler, who in the very early 1920s imagined a Germany and a Europe without a single Jew or gypsy in it. Stop and think for a minute. In 1923, some nut, and he really was a banal nut with a loud voice, who you would, well, I can't say much more than that, but he made Europe, Wales and the Russians as slaves of the Germans. He imagined that, and then he spoke of it loudly. And he made it come to pass. A person is a way for the world to be experienced. When I say experience, I mean it in the phenomenological sense, that you experience the world in many modes. You perceive it, you see it and smell it and taste it, and then you remember it, and you have feelings about it, you form thoughts and beliefs about it, and then you imagine it in its possibilities. These are all ways in which experience occurs. So each person is a way for the world to be experienced and to be acted upon, because each one of you has muscles and a body, and when you do something, it leaves its marks on the world, which is yet another dimension of my talk. Because it used to be, before they had sophisticated instruments, that coal miners and submarine sailors would use a canary to see whether or not the atmosphere was fit for life. And the canary would stop singing and begin to die sooner than the humans. And as soon as the canary began to languish, you knew that it was time to get out of the mine, because if you stayed much longer, you would die of asphyxia. Well, there is a sense in which your own body is a canary. That if you tune in on the experience of your body, what the young kids call vibes, if you're responsive to the vibes that are going on in your world, you'll know whether the other human being with whom you're spending time just then is compatible with your life and growth, or whether they're lethal. There are some persons and scenes in the presence of which you feel vital and alive and you're dancing and you're turned on. And there are others, when you're there. I had a colleague, I hired this son of a bitch on the basis of his vita. He had a whole bunch of publications in an important research area that I needed for some research I was doing. And I ignored the advice of my friends, who, when he came down for an interview, they found him a bore and a drag and a pain in the neck. And I wasn't used to hiring people, and I was still impressed with his record, so I hired him. And he damn near ruined our program. So eventually I had to fire him. But while he was on board, every time he would come into my office, I would be full of beans and juices and ideas and ready to go, and he would just poke his head in my office. I'd get depressed, my ideas would ooze away, I would wonder, was anything worth it? He was literally a male equivalent of a witch. And I now know what it is. There are more ways to communicate than in words. And if someone is profoundly committed to other people's death or minimal functioning or not changing, that message somehow gets communicated. And there's nothing mystical about it. It's communicated in nonverbal cues. So that in a sense, this fellow really was wanting me not to be full of myself. That's a digression, but it can be followed up, and it would be fascinating to develop more sophisticated measuring techniques. Another digression. It hasn't been confirmed, but a police polygraphic expert named Cleve Baxter in New York, he trains cops on lie detection procedures, and he hooked up polygraphs to philodendrons and to eggs. And he presented data that, first of all, when he thought of setting a match to the leaves of his philodendron, on the polygraph it showed a wild alarm reaction. Then he extended his experiments. He dropped brine shrimp into boiling water, thereby killing them in another room, and the philodendron plant sent out an alarm reaction. Then he reports experiments that across the country he did similar experiments, staying in tune with his philodendron plant. It's as if the philodendron plant was recording certain kinds of transmissions. Well, if this is true, And I have some dim inkling that there may be some truth in it. I'm not gullible, but I'm also not close-minded. I certainly know that dogs and children and oneself can respond to the evil or the good intention of the other long before words have been spoken or actions have been acted. You may notice that dogs only bite people who hate dogs. And children don't like the people who they sense don't like spontaneous vitality. The people who hold them and they're afraid the kid is going to puke or crap. Where was I? I'm talking about growth and the discovery and the making actual of more of your possibilities than you have realized just now. Another thing that keeps you in the way that you are, parenthetically, even if it kills you, and it does, and it sickens you, I'm going to talk about a theory of sickness and of death that grows out of what I'm saying just now. But everybody lives in various social systems, a family, a work setting, a community, and each social system generates or invents ways for people to be. They're called roles. Part of it is the division of labor, but it goes beyond that. Ways for people to be that make it possible for that social system to continue in its present form and its present rate of change, which is very slow, non-changing. So that the social systems in which one lives his life, family, work setting, community, have a slot for you or somebody like you. And if you try to change the definition of your slot, you meet a great deal of pressure, threats, to keep you in the way that you need objectively to be in order that that family stay put and remain unchanged with its power structure and its arrangement of privileges and so on. So that one's social systems keep one frozen in one's present way of being. Now, everything then conspires to keep you the way you were yesterday. But the way that you were yesterday may have been an authentic expression of your experience of yourself and the world and the people in it up to yesterday. Today, some new dimensions of the world have become apparent to you. You see and know and understand some new things about the other people, about cars, about the soil, about the world, and some new dimensions of your own experience of your body and your memory appear to you. Now, when there's a change in your experience, you are your experience, so that there is a change in you. Now, the question is, what are you going to do with this enlargement or change in your consciousness, your experience of self and world? It is real. You can't stop the world, and you cannot stop the change that's going on in the world and in your own body. It goes on inexorably, but your awareness of this change doesn't keep pace. And moreover, even if you become aware of the change, new dimensions of yourself, new dimensions of the world, new possibilities, new invitations, to let go of the way that you have been and to start to be in some new ways is terrifying. Because the only way that, the only world you know and the only self you know are the world and self that you knew yesterday. This is what culture shock is about. Or Toffler's book, Future Shock, if any of you have read it, to find yourself not recognizing the world and not recognizing yourself, and your action is no longer effective to satisfy needs or to communicate. Well, man, you are nowhere. But everything conspires to keep you the same, and yet change is going on. Now, what is growth? Growth is the awareness of the change, the acknowledgement of this change, And then, altering one's action, one's behavior, in order to get on with satisfying needs and fulfilling projects and doing your work, but on the basis of the new awareness of self and world. Every time you discover some new dimensions of self and world and change your action and remain vital and viable and alive, we can say you have grown. Every time you deny change or try to remain the person you were when your body and the world have changed, that sets the stage for the onset of sickness. Most sickness, physical and psychological, according to this theory, is proof that you have not grown when it was time to, when you had the signals that it's time to grow. The evidence that it's time to grow is subtle at first. It's experienced as boredom first. What satisfied before is now boring. It's experienced as a subtle change in one's values. One discovers that what was satisfying before isn't satisfying anymore. What was worthwhile before isn't worthwhile anymore. Something has changed. If you then persist trying to pretend you're the person you were when something has changed, then your action no longer satisfies needs or fulfills projects. And so you experience more and more meaninglessness, and you become demoralized. And when you're demoralized, or dispirited, as I call it, you're much more vulnerable to the flu and germs and infectious conditions. Moreover, when you're dispirited in this way, and yet you force yourself to imitate the person that you were yesterday, that gets to be stressing. And stress, as you know, gives you hemorrhoids, high blood pressure, coronary conditions in the physical realm, and psychologically, while all this is going on, you become what we call self-alienated. You're out of touch with who you are. So you're setting the stage for a neurotic or a psychotic breakdown. So if you followed me, failure to grow when it becomes apparent that neither the world nor you are what you took them to be, then you get sick. And from this point of view, since most healers do not help you get into touch with your own reality, then most healers are a menace to health. Most physicians, from this point of view, are a menace to health because they treat your symptoms, but they don't push the causes back far enough. You sicken because you didn't change your way of being when it was time to change. You didn't grow when it was time to grow. Instead, you were anesthetized or disinfected or cut open and then thrown back into the way that you were just before you sickened, and it can be guaranteed you'll sicken again. You see. Everything then conspires to prevent people from growing once they have arrived at their adult family status and occupational status. Americans, or people in the Western world, have long been called elsewhere the once-born people. You're thrust into one incarnation. Elementary school and high school and college and all the mass media and the socialization shapes you up for a family role and an occupational role, and there it is. You then have it made. That's supposed to keep you going until you die, and it worked for quite a few hundred years. But now, with rapid economic change and social change and cultural change, your initial thrust into the world stops being meaningful at increasingly early ages. So that the way my father was kept him vitally involved in life until he died at age 75. He had meaningful and rewarding things to do. I'm 45, and my familial status, husband, father, successful professional person, it's finished. I'm done. At age 45, I could die tomorrow, and I would have done in a certain material sense, what it took my father twice as long to accomplish. Now what do I do? If I continue being a husband and a father and a professor in the ways that I have been, which were successful, I'll kill myself, because I'll die of boredom and the byproduct of stress and disorientation. I have got to invent and discover new dimensions of myself. But this is the rub. This is the rub. Growth and the discovery and the actualizing of new dimensions of self calls for some very hard come-by gifts or skills or courage or something like that. Let me tell you what I mean. Everything conspires to keep you and I the way we are and the way we now are, while it's authentic and viable and fun and rewarding. It finally reaches the end of its tether, and to stay that way any longer, you know damned well, will drive you up the wall or give you an ulcer or sicken you. What then do you do? What most of us do is look around and we see we've got everything a person could want. There must be something wrong with me. I have 3 cars. I really do. 2 houses, 3 sons, 1 wife, 2 houses, and I am miserable, and I'm a full professor. There must be something wrong with me. If I went to a conventional shrink, he would say, Sydney, let's see, you're 45, and that's approaching middle age. And what it is, you've got middle-age depression. It's sort of a male menopause. Now, we understand this, and we know how to treat it. I'll give you some options. If you go into intensive psychoanalytic therapy for about 3 years, 3 sessions a week, $35 a session, we can guarantee we will find the Oedipal roots of this pathology that you are now living. That's one option. Another option is we have some of the latest pharmaceutical products. They are ups as opposed to downs. Some good drugs, antidepressant drugs. And if you'll just take these, you can get on with being a professor and a husband and a father in the way that you're supposed to. And another possibility is if you really get deeply depressed and it really gets rough, why, a few buzzes with the electroshock machine and you'll be as good as new. Do you see what I would invite if I consulted a certain kind of traditional shrink? With a depression that comes on me, that has come on me, that I'm in the middle of just now, it could be regarded as a disease. It's not. It's an indication that the way that I have been has run its course, and I have got to let go of that and discover or find or be shown some other ways for me to be and for the world to be for me. Now, how in the blazes is this going to be possible? Here we get into what I take to be the true meaning of some of the myths, M-Y-T-H, myths. Like the Odyssey myth, as near as I can make out, is a myth about the growth of man from a provincial perspective to a universal perspective. It calls for leaving home. Leave home. Leave Ithaca. Leave your wife and children and aged parents and go out into the world and open yourself up to new experiences and to fight strange enemies for whatever incentive it takes to get you off your ass and out into the world. And Odysseus' case, I suppose it was Helen, or Helen of Troy, or some such reason. And then, exposed to the experiences, you have to fight your way. It's hard to get back home. And then when you're home, you slay your wife's suitors, you bury your father, you marry off your son, and then you make those changes in your world that make it fit for you as a grown person to live and breathe and feel alive in. That's what the Odyssey myth means to me. Well, how do you leave home, and what is home? Home is the identity of outgrown. And as soon as you let go of it, For most people, it scares them silly. The most common and cheap way for people to leave home, to take a trip, is to blast off with a heavy dose of marijuana or acid. That's a way of leaving home. Leaving a way for you to be in the world and a way for the world to be for you. It alters your consciousness of the world. The only trouble with the psychedelics is that unless a person is profoundly committed to a new self in a new world, he just has some kicks or a bad trip and then goes back to the outgrown identity that he was trying to leave, you see. But there are many ways to leave home. Any of the Eastern disciplines, like meditation, are ways of leaving home, disengaging, letting go, becoming unattached. All of these, as I say, can be terrifying if you're not ready, because the only way you know to be and the only way the world is for you is in the way of the identity that you've outgrown and that's sickening you. But if letting go of it is terrifying, then you don't let go and you don't grow. So you stay in your past identity and you sicken. You become the average American. You ought to read Henry Miller. Henry Miller was possibly one of the first really stoned Americans who was stoned not on grass, but just on life. And he, in one of his essays, it's called Staff of Life, there's a collection called The Intimate Henry Miller, and he's talking about bread. Another digression, I can't resist it. He says, you take American bread, it's terrible. It's got sodium propionate in it, it's got everything in it but nourishment. He says, even the birds are suffering from this bread. Their beaks have gotten soft and they're losing their song. He says, the reason why most American men and women, by the time they're in their 30s or 40s, have, and of course he's like Rabelais, he writes with exaggeration. He says, the average American in his 30s and 40s has halitosis, hemorrhoids, constipation, diarrhea, false teeth, false eyes, false hair, and it's all, he says, because of this bread. How did I get on that? Well, it's because they would not grow. That old son of a bitch, Henry Miller, grew. He paid the price every time that his life became non-viable. He acted in a way that a shrink would call psychopathic and irresponsible. But he must be in his 80s now, and he is bawling a 26-year-old chick about his seventh wife, our mistress. All right. How then does one discover one's limits to growth? And how does one discover when he is ready to grow? I already mentioned a couple of hints. When one is bored, when what satisfied yesterday is boring today, that's one hint. When you don't take that hint, then another hint that it's time to grow is decreases in energy and vitality, being sort of tired, pushing yourself through the day. And then when you don't pay attention to that, a sickness, a string of sicknesses. The flu is going around, you get the flu. A virus is going around, you get a virus. If you happen to have a congenital vulnerability, like susceptibility to migraine or to colitis or asthma or something, then you get flare-ups of that. These are all God in his infinite wisdom, God's ways of letting you know that the way you're living just now is not viable. It's time to grow. Boredom, no energy, sickness. It's as if Yahweh is saying, Susan, this is the Lord. I've been trying to catch your attention. The way you're living is not right for you. If you will read Deuteronomy carefully, you'll find that there are a number of my prohibitions and commandments that have to do with life that you are neglecting. You are confusing conservatism or stability or a cosmetic existence with me. And anybody who can't tell the difference between a bank account and Yahweh deserves anything that they get. You see? So that sickness, according to this perspective, is not something to be treated by a physician. Any physician knows that just about anything and everything, if you stop doing what you were doing and take a rest, will cure itself. That most drugs are a menace and a way of enriching the pharmaceutical houses and guaranteeing $50,000 a year net to the physician because he spent 7 years training. Sickness is, it comes closer to the human truth, at least according to my hypothesis, as being your warning. I've been trying to tell you, let go of the way that you're in and look for another way. So then you say, but Lord, Lord, what way? I'm not going to tell you. Ask Billy Graham. He'll tell you. Or ask anybody who thinks he knows the answer. Ronald Reagan will tell you the answer too. So then you say, well, what should I do? Guess. What if I guess wrong? I'll have your ass. What if I guess right? You'll grow and you will be in the promised land. Because again, according to this perspective, the promised land is a way for the world to be for a person. It's not geography. It's not landscape. It's a way for the world to be experienced. And for a growing person is in the promised land. And if you want to know what hell is, it's not the city dump, Gehenna, outside of Jerusalem. Hell is the way the world is for you when you haven't grown, when it was time for you to grow. So how then do you grow? Growth really happens by itself to some extent, because the world is always changing and your own being is changing without your awareness. And part of growth calls simply for getting in touch with reality. And the way that you do that, and it's sometimes frightening, is through meditation and contemplation. Taking a fresh look. Fritz Perls was very good on this, the Gestalt therapy teacher. And when he would talk about really live in the here and now, really look and see what's there, because what's there is not what you thought and believed was there. What is there is what's there. And what is here is what's here. So the way to find out is to perceive. Don't think. Smell, taste, feel, look, and listen. And let it blow your concepts. So really to look and meditate and reflect helps you grow. Because as soon as you discover you and the world aren't the way you believed they were, you're called on to change your action. So meditation and reflection can help you. And in the realm of meditation, anything that will help you disengage from your present, chronic, unexamined ways of being in the world is useful. If it breaks the hypnotic spell, there is a sense in which the world all around you and the people and your name and your friends and your relatives function hypnotically. They say over and over again, you are Susan, you are Susan. And the world is this way, and the world is this way, and you are Susan, and the world is this way. And somebody asks you, who are you, and how is the world? And you say, you know, I am Susan, and the world is this way. Question is, how can you disengage from the world, become unhypnotized, so that you can see the world in yourself in some new dimensions? Any technique of meditation is good for that. Yoga, Zen meditation, any kind of meditation, karate, a walk in the woods, anything that disengages you from the way you were makes it possible for you to conduct a tiny odyssey, because you've left Ithaca, opened yourself up to what exists, and then gone back to take a fresh look at where you were, then to make some changes. What is it about making the changes? That calls for two things, very rare. One is imagination. Is there any way of imagining this marriage, that household, this landscape, that community, this job? Can it be imagined in some other way when the old way has gone stale? My way of being a psychologist grew stale about 10 years ago, and I've been struggling to invent a new way, a different way, a more viable way to be at it, and I'm still pot at it. The business of being a husband and a father, is there some other way of being? My way of being the husband to my wife and the father to my kids was killing the kids and me, and was killing my wife and me. How do you do it different? Do the banal thing, which is divorce, and then marry your wife 180 degrees removed? Or disengage somehow, move out, check out, and take a fresh look at yourself, see who you have become, which is scary and terrifying, and then go back in and have a fresh look and see is how much plasticity, how much malleability is there in you and your situation. That's what's involved in growth. Imagination, to envision some new ways, and then that other rare thing, courage and resolve, because it's an uphill thing. I think the thing that makes me delighted that I grew up in Canada in the Depression as a Canadian and as a Jew means that I had to go uphill for everything. Canadian climate is shitty. If you are weak, you die. At least in those days, Depression days. And nothing came easy. You had to work your ass off to get anything so that you're accustomed to sticking to something. That courage or that resolve seems to be a fairly rare ingredient in this automated world where everybody feels that if it's hard, there must be something wrong with me. Because everything ought to be easy. But the ability to let go, the ability to tolerate being nowhere for a while, because to be nowhere, I'll vouch, is terrifying. Then, to be able to envision another way for yourself and your situation to be, is called. And then, the guts and the gumption and the courage and the resolve to dive back in and make your situation with no guarantee that your first thrust is effective. Lord, Lord, can you give me a guarantee that what I'm doing is right? No. To dive back in and then see what you can do to make your situation livable. There is a growth cycle fully described, and everything militates against it. And yet from another point of view, it's the easiest thing in the world if you let it happen. Let me stop there. Let me take about 5 or 10 minutes, for those of you who would care to guide you to some experience of the present limits to your own growth, or to put it another way, the limits that define your present identity. And let me suggest a kind of a yoga of growth. You know the discipline of hatha yoga, where you get into these peculiar postures. In principle, your body is tremendously rubbery and pliable, and there's nothing to stop you from folding double, in principle, from going over backwards and kissing your own backside, if you're pliable enough. But your body is frozen muscularly in certain chronic postures. Wilhelm Reich called it character armor. But that way for your muscles to remain chronically tense defines your character and one of your ways of being you. In a sense, that arrangement of chronic musculature and facial musculature is your memory, your record of the way that you have been living your life. It's interesting, if you've ever met yogis, I spent some time in India and met about 100 yogis. Each of whom has his ashram and has his disciples and so on. They're an arrogant bunch of buggers. They're not selfless at all. They're as bad as psychologists at a convention. They're not accustomed to having peers, only disciples. But whatever age, they have none of the marks of a lived existence. Their faces are like babies. Their eyes are clear. Even like Satchitananda has this gorgeous beard. I met him, shining eyes. A faultless complexion. I don't know, he's somewhere between 70 and 100 years old. And he's been a hatha yoga teacher, and then he's into other dimensions of yoga. But when you try to do any yoga posture, your muscles prevent you from getting into it. And the discipline, and in some ways every yoga posture, is a little paradigm, a little capsule of a life. Because the only reason for going into one of these absurd postures is because it has meaning for you. And for some, the meaning is health. For somebody, the meaning is liberation. Actually, it's a kind of hoax. Any old reason will do as long as you take the effort to get into one of the postures. But in order to get into the posture, you've got to let go, muscularly, of your chronic ways of being. And if you try to force it, you'll strain a muscle, or you'll rip one. So you can only get into this desired state as much as you have earned. And the only way to earn it, there's no cheating. You can't cheat in hatha yoga, because if you do, something terrible will happen to you. So you press gently against your limits, and you earn your way into that position. Now, listen to the word position as a metaphor. It's a position in life. Everything in life is a position. And the only way to get into the plow position is to let go of the chronic way of being in the world. So just for grins, if you'd like, I'll show you some of your limits that have been laid upon you by upbringing and habit and by your first name and your last name and your social class and your profession and your age. And you can, in a sense, regard that as a kind of paradigm of what's involved in growth, a proof, a model of what's involved in growth. There are these limits that define you as you now are, and if the way you now are is sickening, you've got to get out of it. But in getting away from the way you now are, you discover you have limits. And gently, you abruptly shatter your limits, then you have the equivalent of what an acid head calls a bad trip. But you go gently and respectfully into your limits, and you expand your space, you expand your movement, you expand your awareness. You're sitting. Would you like to stand? Those of you who care to, the others can just watch, because it'll look ludicrous and it'll be fun. Just for grins, do the following thing. I'll do it first and then rap about it for a minute. Get hold of your ankles, or as far down as you comfortably can, your knees or your calves, and very gently pull yourself down as close to your face on your knees as you can make it. Your face on your knees is the finished position, but none of you have earned it. Now, go as far down as you comfortably can. That's your limit. And the reason why you can't go all the way is because of the way you've been living your life just now. But if you gently pressed against those limits 3 minutes a day for about a week, and it was important enough to you, and you discover that your belly got in your way, well, then you would reduce it until eventually you were able to put your face on your knees. See, there's no earthly reason why you can't put your face on your knees. God, in his infinite wisdom, made your muscles pliable, but you buggered it up. You committed it to sitting in chairs and all that sort of thing. Well, the experience of pain that you felt when you went just a little bit further tells you where the limit is and how gently you can press. Now, the equivalent of the pain of trying to get into that position, here are some other positions in life. Let's take another one that has value. Let's say for some absurd reason you ascribed value to getting into the yoga positions. You felt something good would happen for you. Well, here's another one. The capacity to enter into utter, truthful dialogue with another human being. Just for fun, turn to the person next to you that you do not know and tell him or her things about yourself until it begins to be embarrassing. Now, the embarrassment is your limit to the position of utter openness and mutual reciprocal honesty in dialogue. Go ahead, just for fun, give it a try. Start telling the other person about the people you have loved and how you have loved them. Go ahead. The thing is, don't force against your limit. Just experience your limit and balance there, because if you go against it too fast, something bad might happen. I don't want to embarrass you, but if you get into the spirit of the thing, you will perhaps have experienced at least some awkwardness or embarrassment. Just for my feedback, how many of you felt at least a twinge of embarrassment or awkwardness? Some of you. Okay. Let's say that in order to live life more fully, it would be good to be able to get close to another human being. And everything, let's say, conspires against it. The embarrassment about self-disclosure to another person is... You want to keep the other person at a distance, because if they know you too well, you're afraid something bad might happen. And yet, unashamed, open disclosure, we have lots of reason for believing that it's good for you. It's good for growth, it's good for health, it's good to make a relationship vital and alive and so on. So one goes as far into self-disclosing dialogue as one has earned, and then one stops it. And that means you're avoiding growth. All right? Let's argue that another way of being close is with physical contact. Touch the person next to you on various parts of the body until one or the other gets embarrassed. And at that point, you will have discovered a limit, and you can wonder, why that limit? What is it about that limit? Where did it come from? You see? Go ahead, give that one a go. Take another one. I want to call one thing to your... You can sit down if you want just now. Let me just call something to your attention. We think of ourselves as fairly free. But as soon as somebody invites you to do something just a wee bit out of the ordinary that may actually make sense or that could save your life, you discover that there are limits there that you simply weren't aware of before. And when you press against those limits... Those are the limits that define your experience of your own identity and that define the limits of the way for the world to be for you. And if that way for the world to be and you to be in the world has been sickening you, it's time to grow. And growth is either pressing against those limits or pulling out of those limits, which sort of are like a metaphoric armor, in order to grow to full stature. You see, take something like, well, social norms impose all kinds of limits that can and very frequently are sickening. Let's take the freedom to move your own body in different ways. Those of you who would care to play this little game for a minute, stand up and I'll ask you to do something that is... It will look ludicrous, but I'll do it with you. What earthly reason is there for not doing what I'm going to demonstrate, and I'll make an ass out of myself, but I invite you to join me. Is there any earthly reason not to? And not doing it limits your life. Doing it may do something good for you. Watch. Now, from one point of view, you look silly as hell. But from another point of view, it's gorgeous. But the very fact that even I'm fairly liberated, but I'm blushing a bit because I don't know you too well. I feel freer with people that I know well, because I'm a victim, sometimes willing, sometimes not, of social norms. But to certainly you know people who are that defensive, they hang on to the identity that they have been so tightly that if you tried to put a nickel between the cheeks of their buttocks, you couldn't get it in. That is uptight. How could such a person grow? Because one has to let go, and one has to press gently against the limits or drop out. You can use another metaphor to think of your present identity as kind of a suit of armor that you have outgrown. It's awfully tight. And you can do two things. One, try to press against the armor to see if it's flexible enough to give you more room. And if it's not, hold your nose, let go of the hooks, and drop out and be naked and nowhere to see if you can get along without the armor or find another set that is bigger, fits you better. Let me just stop there and ask if you have any comments or questions. Yeah. Go backpacking, take a job in a factory, study flying, take up yoga, meditate. There's nothing sacred about staying in college. One can always come back. I'll authenticate this. I stayed in college because I grew up in the Depression. It was the only way to have some hint that you might make a living. But then I really got hooked. I loved college and I liked studies and I've been a schoolboy all my life. My eldest son went to school because he didn't want to be drafted. And when finally he was to be drafted, he was by then in his sophomore year. And where his heart really was with his band. Is a band, part of a band, they're trying to make it. And he didn't get drafted. He managed to present himself in a way that they didn't want him. and then he said, "Dad, since I've got a 1Y classification, I'm not going to go on with college, I'll finish this quarter." Was halfway through, and then I'm going to drop out. I said, "Drop out now." And he said, "Now? Just now. Why stay in? There's no earthly, you have no zest for being here." So he dropped out. It was marvelous for him. He'd been pursuing his band. He'll go back to school in due course.